Coming up on the show today, after making history on Tuesday, the House of Representatives must find a new leader.
The fractured GOP majority has to pick Kevin McCarthy's successor. First, Louisiana's Garrett Graves says it needs to let the anger over his removal subside.
Plus, Joe Biden is pressing for aid to Ukraine.
The Pentagon warned that without action from Congress, funding to support the effort against Russia's invasion could run out in months.
And later, VOA talks with Afghani migrants in Pakistan, and we get a preview of the historic meeting of Catholic bishops underway in Rome. Today is Thursday, October 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We begin today in Washington, where the U.S. House of Representatives remains adrift a day after the first ever removal of a speaker. AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
The fractured GOP majority has to pick Kevin McCarthy's successor. First, Louisiana's Garrett Graves says it needs to let the anger over his removal subside.
Letting people go home and kind of decompress a little bit is a good idea.
Many Republicans have left town, awaiting what may be votes on a new speaker next week. Majority Leader Steve Scalise is in line, but faces a challenge from conservative favorite Jim Jordan.
Are you planning to run for the speaker position?
No, we are. Yep, we are.
Others are likely to emerge, and Texas's Chip Roy says the internal debate continues.
We just need a strong speaker, a strong leader.
Asked his advice for whomever wins.
That's a bubbly paper.
While President Biden wouldn't weigh in, Senate Democratic Chief Chuck Schumer did.
Think carefully about what happened to your predecessors.
Saying John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and McCarthy coddled the hard right.
Each of your predecessors got burnt each time.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
So we now know that Kevin McCarthy is out as Speaker and that Republican Representatives Steve Scalise and Jim Jordan have each announced that they'd like the job. But how did we get here? And what's the process for moving forward? Reuters' Angela Johnston takes a look.
The U.S. House finds itself in an unprecedented situation. It won't have a leader for at least a week after Kevin McCarthy became the first ever House Speaker to be booted from the job by rebellious Republicans. What's next for the country? And how might the rebellion impact the grand old party? Until a new speaker is installed, it's unlikely Congress will take action on bills to fund the government. That legislative halt comes as another government shutdown deadline looms on November 18th. But with Republicans needing a week to choose a new speaker, it would stall talks on government funding. Hard right conservatives like House Representative Matt Gaetz, who called for McCarthy's ouster, were angry over the then speaker's failure to win extremely deep spending cuts in those funding bills. But if the eventual goal in removing McCarthy is to shut down the U.S. government, Princeton University professor Sean Wilentz says that tactic could backfire on the GOP, as it did only a few decades ago with Newt Gingrich.
If this is a prelude to shutdown, historically, shutdowns have not been very productive for the party that shuts down the Congress. I mean, this happened in the 90s, which is really the beginning of this history in some ways with Gingrich. And, the Republicans unleashed Gingrich thinking that he would do a good job against the Democrats. And then he decided to take the whole country down with him with two shutdowns that basically reelected Bill Clinton in 1996. So if you're going back on that precedent, if I was a Democrat, I'd say go ahead. The only problem is that we have to live with the effects of a government shutdown, which are very, very dire. And you don't want that to happen. You don't want to be the party that benefits from that, because everybody's going through a disaster, much worse now even than in the 90s.
For now, the House has selected an acting speaker, Republican Patrick McHenry, a McCarthy ally. But he really only has one task, to find a new speaker. Anything more than that, and it would spark another rebellion from the hard right. A date for the next speaker election is set whenever leaders of both parties decide they're ready to enter the process of electing a speaker. Normally, the elections for Speaker are scheduled at the start of the new Congress every 2 years. Multiple Republicans said they plan to meet on October 10th to discuss possible McCarthy successors, with a vote on a new Speaker planned for October 11th. The deep divisions in the GOP were on display in January, as McCarthy for days could not get enough votes to win the speaker position and had to endure 15 ballots. Things could be as chaotic this time around for the Republicans, unless they unite after concluding the chaos has sparked public backlash and dimmed their election prospects in 2024.
That's Reuters' Angela Johnston. Following the dramatic ousting of Republican Kevin McCarthy from his role as House Speaker just days after the U.S. Congress ditched provisions for further funding for Ukraine in order to avert a government shutdown, the White House is left scrambling. It's pushing for a deal to maintain U.S. support for Kyiv and defending itself against Russia's invasion before the money runs out in a matter of months. President Joe Biden has warned allies that the lapse could make all the difference in the battlefield. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wita-Kuswara reports.
As Ukrainian soldiers grind through their counteroffensive, the Pentagon warned that without action from Congress, funding to support the effort against Russia's invasion could run out in months. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden said he will deliver a major speech to persuade the American people to stay the course.
I'm going to make the argument that it's overwhelmingly in the interest of the United States of America that Ukraine succeed.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre declined to provide further details on the president's speech, but acknowledged in response to VOA's question that American public support is waning.
Yeah, we see the polling and we get that. We understand. But we also believe that it is fundamentally important to our own national security as well as supporting the brave people of Ukraine to continue that support.
On Tuesday, just days after the U.S. Congress ditched provisions for further Ukraine assistance in a deal to avert a government shutdown, Republican Kevin McCarthy was ousted as House Speaker. Jim Jordan, the first Republican to publicly declare his intention to succeed McCarthy, said Wednesday he is against an aid package for Ukraine.
The most pressing issue on Americans' minds is not Ukraine. It is the border situation, and it is crime on the streets.
Other potential candidates include number two House Republican Steve Scalise and Kevin Hearn, chair of the Republican Study Committee, the largest Republican caucus in the House. House Republicans plan to meet Tuesday for a first round of internal party voting. A lapse in funding could impact Ukraine's battlefields and embolden Moscow, said Luke Coffey, a senior fellow focusing on foreign policy at the Hudson Institute.
They're very hopeful that this continued chaos stays in the United States and that there isn't any funding for Ukraine.
Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said Monday he remains confident about U.S. support. Patsy Wita-Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
In New York, the civil trial of former President Donald Trump continued for a third day, though much of the day's excitement happened outside the courtroom. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The New York State Attorney General says Donald Trump's comments are offensive and baseless and calls his appearance at his civil fraud trial nothing but a political stunt. Donald Trump showed up for the first 3 days of his civil trial, even though he didn't have to come to court until he testifies and was defiant.
The corrupt attorney general sued me for fraud.
And
they made up a fake case.
State Attorney General Letitia James says the lawsuit against Trump lays out how he inflated the worth of his assets.
The Donald Trump show is over. This was nothing more than a political stunt.
Meanwhile, Trump's accountant testified that the former president supplied the figures for financial statements, but on cross-examination, defense lawyers pinned the blame on that accountant. Trump's attorneys are also appealing the judge's pretrial ruling that he inflated assets. At the courthouse in Manhattan, I'm Julie Walker.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Ukraine, Poland, and Lithuania have agreed to a plan to expedite Ukrainian grain exports. The deal means that grain inspections will shift from the Ukraine-Poland border to a Lithuanian port on the Baltic Sea. The Somali government on Wednesday said that government troops have killed hundreds of militants, including 19 al-Shabaab commanders, during military operations in the past 2 months. Casualty figures given by the Somali government have not been independently verified. All this as a Somali regional official is calling for an extension of the deadline set for African Union troops to leave Somalia, citing continued al-Shabaab attacks and an unstable political situation. And it was announced on Wednesday that the 2030 World Cup will play out across three continents. The World Cup is usually limited to one host nation, sometimes two, but 2030's edition will be hosted by an unprecedented six countries: Spain, Portugal, Morocco, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Hollywood writers are back on the job after accepting a contract offer and ending their strike last week. Actors, however, are still on the picket line. Among their demands is limiting the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, in movie making. From Los Angeles, Genia DeLute has our story.
The deal ending the writer's strike includes protections against studios using artificial intelligence to write or rewrite literary material. Union member Angela Jorgensen says that's exceptional.
By putting restrictions on the amount of AI content that can be used, and also by preventing AI from being trained on the work that we writers create, they're going to help protect our jobs.
Studios will be required to tell writers if any material given to them has been generated by AI, while writers will have the freedom to use programs such as ChatGPT if they like. Writer Al Septian says that's a win.
We can use AI if we choose to, but we can't be forced to. So using AI cannot diminish the compensation or the credit of a writer, of a human writer. So that's huge.
Some writers are continuing to back striking actors, whose labor concerns also include the use of AI. Actor Rong Song says the fight for consent over use of actors' digital replicas starts at the creation.
If there's any sort of wordage or verbiage in relationship to artificial intelligence being used in perpetuity, a likeness to be taken and used in perpetuity without the actor's consent, or as part of the contract to be able to eliminate an actor if they don't sign an agreement that has to do with artificial intelligence.
The new 3-year deal for writers also includes pay increases and bonuses for streaming content. Writer Jasmine Peck was encouraged by provisions expanding opportunities for underrepresented writers.
Black writers, queer writers, like any writer from a population that is not a part of the already very reflected majority. Disabled writers, like anyone that's coming from a population that like has not historically been at the forefront of storytelling in this industry.
There was no statement from the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers about details of the deal with writers. Those studio heads resumed talks with the Screen Actors Guild Monday. Genia Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. A historic meeting in Rome to discuss the future of the Catholic Church is underway, and we'll find out about a very large prize for some very small things. That's all coming up. Now, we go to Pakistan, where authorities have ordered all illegal immigrants to leave voluntarily by November 1st or face deportation. The new order primarily affects Afghans, many of whom fled their country after the Taliban took over in August of 2021. VOA's Pakistan bureau chief, Sara Zaman, met with some Afghan women who once again are facing an uncertain future.
This Afghan mother of three left Taliban-ruled Afghanistan for her family's safety last year and moved to Pakistan.
My husband was a journalist there. He worked for Americans, so we can't go back because his life would be in danger there.
Soon, she may be forced to leave Pakistan as well. Halima, who asked VOA to call her by this name to protect her identity, is one of 1.73 million Afghans, according to Pakistani government data, who are living illegally in the country. Under a new government order, all illegal residents must leave voluntarily by November 1st. Sarfaraz Bukhti is Pakistan's caretaker interior minister.
If they don't leave until November 1st, then all of the state's law enforcement, whether it's provincial or federal, we will use all of that enforcement to deport them.
Speaking to VOA's Urdu service, Taliban's consul general in Peshawar, Hafiz Mohibullah, warned the decision could damage bilateral ties.
This hasty decision will negatively affect ties between the two neighboring countries.
Though not a signatory to UN resolutions protecting refugee rights, Pakistan is home to over 4 million Afghans. Most arrived in the last four decades or were born to refugees in Pakistan and have paperwork legalizing their stay. But those who arrived after Taliban's 2021 takeover of Afghanistan largely lack permits. Halima and her husband arrived on valid visas, but their latest extension request was denied.
When I go outside, I am lost in my thoughts because I don't have a visa. My husband doesn't have a visa. What should we do? If the police come and arrest him, what will I do with my three children?
Pakistan's decision comes after months of deadly terror attacks. Officials say evidence shows Afghan nationals were involved in several. Human rights groups and the UNHCR have urged Pakistan not to force out Afghans seeking refuge. But Pakistani Interior Minister Sarfaraz Bhukti says his country is only implementing the law.
The concept of the nation state is that illegal practices, illegal means are not promoted in any country. We won't allow that either.
In a message on X, formerly Twitter, Afghan Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid said Pakistan's behavior against Afghan refugees is unacceptable. But a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan is not acceptable for Halima and her neighbors who are banned from studying and working there.
Our lives are in danger there. Our lives are in danger here. Our lives are ruined.
With the clock ticking, uncertainty is only mounting. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
From Islamabad to Rome, where Pope Francis has opened the Synod, or meeting of Roman Catholic bishops from all over the world. For the first time, it includes lay people and women. As Sabrina Castelfranco reports, a number of thorny issues are on the agenda over the next few weeks, all behind closed doors.
With a solemn mass in St. Peter's Square Wednesday, Pope Francis formally opened a four-week meeting that gathers 365 select members with voting rights, including lay people and not just bishops. It will also see women voting for the first time. No binding decisions will be made, but controversial topics are up for discussion at the closed-door meeting held in Vatican City's Paul VI Hall. They include the role of ordinary Catholics, including women, in decision-making processes, whether priests should be allowed to marry, and the Church's teachings on divorce and LGBTQ issues. The theme of the meeting is For a Synodal Church, Communion, Participation, Mission. Commentators say it is likely to expose deep divisions between liberals and conservatives in the Roman Catholic Church. In his homily at Wednesday's Mass, Pope Francis said church leaders at the gathering do not need a purely natural vision made up of human strategies, political calculations, or ideological battles. The Pope added, "We are not here to carry out a parliamentary meeting or a plan of reformation. The Synod," he said, "is not a parliament." Before the start of discussions, five conservative cardinals called on Pope Francis to reaffirm the Church's doctrine on same-sex couples and the ordination of women. In a letter, they presented five questions and expressed their concern that some in church leadership are no longer proposing sound doctrine, but teachings according to their own likings. In a written response, the pontiff steered away from providing the yes-no answers the cardinal requested, and observers say he appeared to be open to the possibility of blessing same-sex couples. The 86-year-old pontiff said that we cannot be judges who only deny, reject, and exclude. He wrote, "Pastoral prudence must adequately discern whether there are forms of blessing requested by one or more persons that do not convey a mistaken concept of marriage." At Wednesday's Mass, Pope Francis said the Synod aims to reaffirm a church that looks mercifully at humanity and is united and fraternal, that listens and dialogues, a church that blesses and encourages. Ahead of the meeting, Vatican officials said no media would be allowed, and attendees were instructed to not speak to reporters about the discussions. Sabina Castelfranco, VOA News, Rome.
And finally today, three scientists have won the very large Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their work on very tiny quantum dots. VOA's Kim Lewis has more.
The scientists were honored for their work with the tiny particles that are just a few atoms in diameter and whose electrons have constrained movement. Hans Ellengren, Secretary General of the Nobel Committee, announced the winners.
Mondye Bavendi, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, USA. Louise Bruce, Columbia University, USA, and Alexei Yekimov, Nanocrystals Technology, Incorporated, USA.
The scientists' work is used in many electronics like LED displays. Kim Lewis, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In remarks at a side event during the recent UN General Assembly, U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, Beth Van Schaack, noted that oppression of the Uyghurs by the government of the People's Republic of China is ongoing and evolving.
We are now particularly concerned about the dramatic increase in prosecutions with long-term sentences in Xinjiang, including the reported transfer of some detainees from so-called re-education or vocational training centers into more formal penal prisons. Data from human rights groups indicate that of the more than 15,000 Xinjiang residents whose sentences are known, more than 95% of those convicted, often under very vague charges like separatism or endangering state security, have received sentences of 5 to 20 years and in some cases of life.
Such is the recently reported case of prominent Uyghur scholar Rahil Dawut, according to the Dewi Hua Foundation, a U.S.-based human rights organization. A Chinese government source confirmed that Ms. Dawut was sentenced to life behind bars. She reportedly lost her appeal of a 2018 conviction on the charge of splitism, a crime of endangering state security. A prominent academic who lectured at universities around the world on Uyghur folklore and traditions, Ms. Dawut was a professor at Xinjiang University when she disappeared in 2017. The United States condemns Rahil Dawut's life sentence, which, as State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said in a written statement, was handed down after secret court proceedings. Professor Dawut and other Uyghur intellectuals, including Ilham Tohti, have been unjustly imprisoned for their work to protect and preserve Uyghur culture and traditions. Professor Dawut's life sentence is part of an apparent broader effort by the PRC to eradicate Uyghur identity and culture and undermine academic freedom, including through the use of detentions and disappearances, said spokesperson Miller. We call upon the PRC government to immediately end the genocide and crimes against humanity against Uyghurs and members of other ethnic and religious minority groups in Xinjiang and to abide by its international commitments to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms. We continue to call on the PRC government to immediately release Professor Dawut and all individuals who are unjustly detained. As U.S. Ambassador at Large Van Schaack has said, as these atrocities continue, the world must stand firm against them, both in word and in deed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.